Science fiction has a way of becoming science fact over time, and maybe we don't have robots with full-blown personalities hanging around us yet, but we do have robots that look like people and pets that we depend more upon over time for things like simple comfort and companionship, and yes, sex, too. Our guest has spent some time thinking through the implications of that kind of human-robot connection, particularly to the issue of how we humans treat those machines. Nancy Jecker is a bioethicist at the University of Washington Medical School and an adjunct professor in the philosophy department of the School of Law at UW. Earlier this year, she published the paper, Can We Wrong a Robot?, which we'll explore now. Nancy Jecker, thanks for joining us.
Thanks very much, Jeff. Pleasure to be here.
So for the people, me included, who don't even have a Roomba yet, what kinds of things are robots doing for us these days?
Great question. Well, as you know, I'm a philosopher, so what I try to do is anticipate possibilities, and I focus on how to design and deploy social robots in ways that would preserve valued features of social life. So what future robots are like is not fixed. It's partly up to us. As an ethicist, I ask, what kind of relationships do we want to have, should we have, with social robots now and in the future?
And there are certainly some circumstances that make you think about this. The Can We Wrong a Robot Again is the title of your essay with a question mark at the end. What got you started thinking about this particular issue or set of issues?
Well, I came into the topic of robots and artificial intelligence sort of through the back door. I was writing a book on individual and population aging called Ending Midlife Bias, and I was focused on caregiving for older adults who need assistance with activities of daily living. And I was trying to solve a problem, and it's a supply problem. So we need an alternative to family caregiving in an aging society. Older people are living longer and longer, and there's a lopsided ratio between older and working age adults. They're changing roles for women in the family. One fix is employing migrant workers from low-income countries to come here and take care of our older adults. But that has its own set of problems. It tends to be exploitive. These so-called global care chains tend to exploit women in poorer countries, pay them meager wages, promise them the moon, and then they're frequently physically and emotionally abused and trapped. So I had the idea, what about robots? Couldn't we supply, in principle, an infinite number of them and meet the demand? And then I talked about how we ought to go about it. So that's sort of how I became interested in the topic. And now I've sort of taken a deeper dive and look more fully into the broader issues related to social robots, like I do in this paper you mentioned.
And the paper begins with a discussion about a particular incident in Australia in 2017, and it involves a sex robot called Samantha. What happened to Samantha?
At an electronics festival in Austria.
Austria,
2017, yes. A sex robot named Samantha was reportedly molested, and her breasts and other body parts were badly damaged. Two of her fingers were broken off, and she was heavily soiled. It was basically a crowd run amok. And some considered this behavior not just shameful, but a violation of Samantha's moral rights. So some considered it a wrong to Samantha. And when I looked into this case, one of the things that struck me is if we look to contemporary Western philosophy, it suggests the opposite view, so it doesn't really explain a reaction to the case of Samantha. Western philosophy tells us that robots can't be wronged because they function merely as tools to realize human ends. You mentioned the Roomba, the robotic vacuum cleaner.
Mm-hmm.
They're like that, and they are tools for us, and we can't wrong a toaster, so of course we can't wrong a sex robot like Samantha. So I challenge this view, and I look beyond Western discourse to some insights drawn from Eastern philosophy, in particular Japanese Shinto philosophy, and an environmental philosophy known as deep ecology.
All right. We're talking to Nancy Jecker, a bioethicist at the University of Washington Medical School, adjunct professor in the philosophy department and School of Law, about human relations with robots and the question that Nancy raises in her paper published this year, Can We Wrong a Robot? With a question mark at the end. Answer the question yourself, 800-838-3760 by phone, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. So as you delved into the Shinto religion and the other tradition you mentioned, what kinds of differences did you find? I mean, are there parts of the world that do think differently about, you know, whacking a robot or a toaster or whatever the inanimate object is on some basis?
Definitely. So the title of the paper is "Can We Wrong a Robot?" And the answer I give is yes. And I don't justify the answer by Western philosophy. I look into some of the Eastern philosophies, and one that I draw on quite heavily is an environmental philosophy known as deep ecology. And this is inspired by Sherpas, which are an indigenous people of Nepal. A deep ecology seeks to capture the reverence and the awe that the Sherpas show toward nature, and in particular toward the Himalayan mountains and other natural features that they consider to be sacred. So we can contrast shallow ecology, which focuses on conserving nature for us, with deep ecology, which emphasizes that natural things are valuable in their own right. And just to say a little bit more about that, deep ecology holds that what's ethically crucial is not the pleasure we derive from nature, the uses we put it to, but the valuable whole that constitutes our human connection to it. So, in other words, we're able to relate to objects in nature in ways that are intrinsically valuable. And in these relationships, nature, natural objects, are constituents of this valuable whole. They're not some outside thing that we're trying to get. And so I argue, I draw an analogy. I say, like objects in nature, which can be parts of valuable experiences, parts of a richer, more flourishing human life, social robots, so I'm not talking about the toaster or the Roomba, social robots can be constituents of valuable robot-human relationships.
I keep trying to come at this from a psychology perspective, and I realize I'm talking to a philosopher, but it does come back to a basic question for me, which is what does that say about the person who would inflict the damage? Less about the robot, but about the person who's on the delivery end of any particular harm.
Well, what I call robophobia is fed by a lot of sources. A lot of people are afraid of robots. I think it's almost guttural. We're afraid of what we regard as other. You know, there's a fear of a dystopian society where robots run amok. There are many depictions of this in film and fiction. And some people resent machines because they believe they're stealing human jobs. So this sometimes gets expressed through violence, hostility towards robots. I mentioned the Austrian Electronics Festival. There are other examples in the United States, in Japan, and other parts of the world where you have a lot of hostility expressed towards robots. It's a sort of neo-Luddite sentiment. You know, the Luddites were 19th century textile workers who opposed new ways of working, and they attacked textile machinery. They thought it was evil. And a lot of people find new things, find change really threatening and discomforting. So I think it says a lot about us. And I do think, you know, I think there's also technology enthusiasts who forecast, you know, a singularity and take the opposite view. But I think robots are already here and we are going to be living with them. So I'm concerned with how we ought to go about it. How should we design and deploy them in ways that will enhance our lives and create new valuable relationships.
Listeners, what do you think? Join the conversation with Nancy Jecker, the bioethicist from the University of Washington, at 800-838-3760 by phone, by email jx@jeffnet.org. Here's a call from Mark in Reading. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange.
If robots are property, the robot itself has no rights. The owner of the property has rights. If a person owns a pencil, they can snap the pencil in two and throw it away because it's their property. Now, if you own a robot and you wish to destroy the robot, well, that's your business. But if you rent a robot from a company, then you are harming that company if you damage the robot.
All right. So, and also, if you damage a robot.
The idea that, that robots in and of themselves, if they are property, have rights is in my mind ridiculous.
All right, thanks for that, Mark. Appreciate it. And you did, in fact, explore the concept of ownership in your work, didn't you, Nancy?
I did. And I want to, just in response to Mark's question, thank you very much for that question, Mark. I want to draw a distinction between what's legal and illegal on the one hand, And, you know, the area of robots and the law is really, it's a gray area. We have a lot of decisions still to make about how we want to regard robots and other artificially intelligent beings. So it's an open question what the law is going to be. But my focus is really on right and wrong, not legal and illegal. So we might be able to do lots of things that we shouldn't do. There's large swaths of morality and ethics where we don't legislate, but we have justified views about how we ought to behave. So the question of whether robots are merely property from a moral as opposed to a legal standpoint, in response to your comment, I would say that, women were once property too. So our views are evolving. And if we design robots in ways where they are highly emotionally intelligent and engage and get to know us in ways that are truly valuable, I think how we come to regard them will change. They're almost like a new genre, a new kind of thing. They're somewhere in between a conscious, sentient adult human being and a mere machine. They're a different kind of thing, I would argue. And we're still figuring out and making choices about how we want them to be and how we want to interrelate with them. So thanks again for your question, Mark.
Yeah, indeed, Mark. Thanks for that. So that really is the baseline of this set of ethics we're talking about here is not just how we're going to treat the robots, but how we're going to design the robots to be in the first place, how far we want to take our connections to them as creatures that respond to us in ways similar to humans. Yes? Do we lose Nancy?
I'm here.
Oh, there you go.
I'm sorry. Okay. What was the question? I'm sorry, Jeff.
What happened was that I was saying that this is really, you're getting back to the baseline set of ethics then, not so much about how we treat, but at the even before that, having to figure out how to build robots, how to design robots.
Exactly. I think that's really the interesting question. There's a lot of attention to what are they going to be like, and there's a lot of debate between these technology enthusiasts and these sort of neo-Luddites that some think, they're going to replace us. There perhaps is a byproduct of the so-called singularity, a moment when machines become so intelligent they start designing themselves, and then there'll be rapid progress. And then there are the neo-Luddites who, show a sort of anger and hostility toward them and are trying to shut the whole enterprise down. So that debate gets a lot of attention, but I think the more interesting questions philosophically and really in terms of the technology is, how should we design them? What do we want? And one of the reasons to motivate the focus on social robots is a lot of human beings are very socially isolated and lonely. And the pandemic has increased awareness of this, of the importance of social connections. And what some listeners might not know is that social isolation and loneliness were really major problems before the pandemic, and they're going to continue to be so after the pandemic is over. And I think that social robots can serve really important and highly valued functions in our society. When we're socially isolated and lonely, it's bad for us. There's a lot of evidence that it makes us sick, and it can even kill us. So there's decades of research showing that social isolation and loneliness predicts all-cause mortality at a level that matches well-documented clinical risk factors like smoking and, eclipses others like obesity. So social isolation and loneliness is a problem in the United States and really throughout the world. And it's not that robots would be replacing a doting human companion. It's that some people have no human companions. And social robots can, if we design them properly, fill an important role.
Well, let's move into the realm then of sex robots for a moment. I have to believe this is not something that would appeal to every human, even a human who's not had sex for a long time, but they do exist.
They do exist. They're not highly sophisticated at this point, but I think that will change. I think there's a demand for it. The current social robots are, designed for a certain end user, so they tend to be overwhelmingly designed for heterosexual, young, able-bodied, white men. And there are very few male sex bots, and there are very few sex bots designed for people who are disabled, people who are older, have difficulties, age-related difficulties with sexual performance. There are very few sex robots that are depicted as targeting non-heterosexual individuals. So I think that the part of what the sex robot technology and sex robot industry shows us is that as we continue to develop sex robots, and they're currently fairly primitive, but as we continue to develop them, we need to avoid algorithmic biases. So we need to bring in a diverse group of designers. We need to have design them for a wide range of end users. My focus has been older end users, but more broadly, we need to really think about how to design them in ways that will be meaningful and create meaningful relationships for a whole range of people.
Well, you mentioned older users, and that was actually where I went yesterday for some additional research, as I went off in the direction of looking for the pet companion robots that I know exist out there, and checked out one of the websites for it, and there are lots of videos there. And I don't know, I certainly had some mixed feelings about that. It's a little weird in one sense that you have this cooing, purring, meowing kitty. But then also, you don't have to clean up after it. And if you're older and really don't have much ability to care for a pet in that way, maybe this is the answer.
I think it can serve an important function. I'm glad you brought up pet robots, because we've been talking primarily about humanoid robots when we talk about social robots. But of course, the first breakthrough designs were in robotic seals and robotic dogs and robotic cats. And they perform a function that many feel is less threatening and more easily integrated into, you know, a family or into an individual's life if they live alone and are older, as you mentioned. And I think that can do quite a bit toward addressing the problem of social isolation and loneliness that I mentioned earlier. So, yes, I think we need a range of different social robots, humanoid and non-humanoid. We need to be careful about who's selling them to us and how they're being designed, and make sure that they're designed for diverse end users. We need to be sure that we protect privacy when we design social robots, because they'll be privy to a lot of information about their users.
Oh,
and we
yes.
need to design them in ways that, that don't come up against a digital divide, that are more accessible to a larger group of people.
All right, down to our last minute, Nancy, we've got a question from Scott in Ashland, who says, if a sex robot has rights because it is programmed to respond socially, does my PC or my iPad, which has much more sophisticated software that simulates social interaction, also have rights?
That raises an interesting question as to whether non-humanoid robots, especially those who are not just programmed but artificially intelligent, learn, if they can have rights too. And it's less intuitive to us because we're so impacted by the appearance of things. But I can imagine your PC creating a hologram, a digital kind of image that you do bond to. And we have depictions in film and we have depictions in mm-hmm. fiction of that occurring. So I think, again, if we have a valuable relationship, it's possible that we have some responsibilities toward the robot.
All right. Yeah, some responsibilities to the other end of the relationship. The papers asks, Can We Wrong a Robot? By Nancy Jecker, a bioethicist at the University of Washington. Nancy, thanks for joining us on The Exchange.
My pleasure, Jeff. Thank you.
You bet.